It's a Monday on Today in Ohio, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and the Plain Dealer. Specifically, it's the Monday following the Friday when the U.S. Supreme Court stopped recognizing the right to abortion in this country, ending 50 years of precedent. Lots to talk about on that topic on this episode. I'm Chris Quinn. I am here with Lisa Garvin, Laura Johnston, and Layla Atassi. It's a Monday. You guys ready to start talking?
Yeah.
Lots to talk about.
All right. The U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade on Friday, rejecting a half century of precedents recognizing a woman's right to choose an abortion. Set off an immediate movement in Ohio to restrict or outlaw abortion. Laura, let's go through some of it.
Okay, so Ohio is one of the states expected to make abortion illegal under most circumstances. We don't have a trigger law that automatically takes effect, but the state legislature could pass anything anytime, although they're on recess until November. But already you cannot have an abortion in this state after fetal heartbeat is detected, because 8 hours after the ruling, it was already granted. The injunction was removed. So that law, which was passed a couple of years ago, is now in effect. So and both Matt Huffman and Bob Kupp are for an abortion ban. So you can only expect that's coming.
All right. Let's stop there and talk about this a little bit.
Yeah.
Because Ohioans do not favor that. Any poll that's ever been done across America, there's a stronger sentiment, but in Ohio, the majority favor maintaining what was in existence under Roe v. Wade. So when Huffman, Kupp, and DeWine are doing this, they are playing to the fringe part of their party, hoping to stay in office, because they're going against the will of Ohioans. So they're going to do this. They're going to outlaw abortion, even though Ohio does not want that. What are the possible remedies to that?
Well, we could have a referendum, right, where a citizen-led effort to put our own constitutional amendment on the ballot, which voters could then decide to make abortion legal in Ohio. And obviously, you'd have to have a group to champion that. They'd have to get a lot of signatures, and then there'd be a vote. And what that amendment would entail is tricky, and we've talked about it in a special episode of Today in Ohio. It would likely give the right, but have kind of narrow it somewhat. I don't think it would pass if it was an out and out, just you are allowed to do that. And you'd have to look at what the legislature could do to that amendment once it was passed. So you'd probably, you know, I don't think it's going to come tomorrow. I think they're going to be taking some time to craft something that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I just wonder who's going to do it. The upshot of that episode, and we did get some very strong feedback from people asking us to have more podcasts like that,
yes,
was that you should recognize a right to a woman's choice on the issue, but with a limit that says, you know, up until this point, and after that point, it should be a decision between the medical the patient and the doctor, that there should be concerns. There was a very strong sentiment in that podcast that this really needs to be left to a woman and her doctor.
Right, that it is a medical procedure, and that politicians are not medical experts.
Yeah, and how you fashion that is the key. The other thing you're seeing is a call on prosecutors to say they won't prosecute it. Rebecca Maher, the city councilwoman, was on social media almost immediately saying, we need to hear from our prosecutors that they won't prosecute it. So, Layla, you've spent some time dealing with our prosecutor, Michael Malley, over the years, and the city prosecutor would have a say. Do you think we'll see anything from them saying, yeah, we're not prosecuting these cases?
I don't know. I can't speak for him, but I'm sure that our reporters are gonna be following up to see if we can get him on the record to commit to that position.
You can't see where this is a priority, right? I mean, we have a lot of violence issues. We have all sorts of cases to prosecute. There's not enough police officers, probably not enough prosecutors, that this would be the thing they go after.
I know. Yeah. Right. But what happens then when there are anyway, I'm just beside myself.
Okay, all right,
I don't know if I can.
So Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. We got up on a Saturday morning. Lisa, mm-hmm. you said it for the podcast. You got up Saturday morning and you felt like you were in a different America.
I did. And the frightening thing to me is that what Clarence Thomas said, he said he's going after Griswold, Lawrence, and Obergefell next. Of course, Justice Alito right. said, oh, well, this is just narrowly focused on abortion, but that door has been cracked open. And let's not forget, they knocked a huge brick out of the church versus state wall with a ruling last week that allows religious institutions to take taxpayer money, religious schools, to get taxpayer money while they are themselves tax exempt. So this seems like a plan that's been put in motion, and I think we're only seeing the beginning of it, and that's what really frightens me. My gay friends are horribly frightened.
Well, what the thing that was most strange for me about the Thomas concurrence was the idea of paving the way to outlaw contraception.
Right.
I mean,
right.
conservative Republicans want to have sex without having babies, so I don't get that. What I mean, that's not about life. That's not about all of the arguments people use on abortion. Why on earth would you outlaw contraception, which would lead to a flood of unwanted children and much higher health care costs for everybody? Insurance rates would go through the roof. I just don't get that one.
I don't either. Have you seen the viral letter to the editor that's going around that says, you know, if we're going to outlaw abortion and, you know, contraception could be next, then every child should be paternity tested and the father should be held as equally responsible for the upbringing and the cost of care of this child for the rest of their lives. I want to see that get passed, right? Not that I really think you should be forced paternity testing, but it makes you think about this is not a children take two, right? It's not just a woman.
Right. Right. Well, look, you know, progress is not a straight line. Progress
no.
has lots of steps backward. This was a step backward. It's the first time the Supreme Court has overturned an established precedent that every one of these justices testified to restrict rights. Usually when you overturn a precedent, it's to expand rights. Let's talk about Dave Yost.
Yeah.
Laura, you mentioned Dave Yost wasted no time at all pushing in for the heartbeat bill, which in many ways is an outright abortion ban because most women or many women don't even know they're pregnant at that point.
Right, because the earliest you could detect a fetal heartbeat is about 6 weeks. And just to do the basic, you know, medical education here, you count it from a woman's period. So you're not even pregnant until you're 2 weeks pregnant. So you would have to be paying pretty close attention and make, you know, that you missed a period or, you know, that you're watching this to even know that you're pregnant. So that was passed nearly 3 years ago, and it was immediately had an injunction on it. So as soon as the decision came down, Yost filed to get it lifted. And 8 hours later... I mean, I don't know how they decided this so quickly. Other things take years to come out. But hey, the court said, sure, the heartbeat ban can stand.
Well, except that the whole reason it was being held up was because of Roe v. Wade. And so, Yost represents the state. And when one of its laws is being held back, he does have a responsibility to represent the state. That was passed by the legislature, signed by the governor. I'm not sure... Yost had much choice but to go
but
to court.
But it was very quick.
Yeah, but he also said that Roe was poorly reasoned, too. I mean, you know, he obviously was against it. And the thing that's kind of scary here is that he's asking the Attorney General Merrick Garland to hold violent protesters liable no matter what side they're on. But, I wonder who's going to get more prosecution in these protests.
You know, there is the logic that was used in this ruling to overturn Roe v. Wade has been discussed for decades, and Congress has known that. There have been times when Democrats controlled Congress, they could have passed a law that enshrined abortion in state law in case this day came, and they didn't. And a lot of state legislatures have had 5 decades to say, you know, we have a ruling that says this, but there's nothing behind that that protects it. I mean, I think everybody that's held elected office that believes in a woman's right to choose takes some of the blame for not enshrining this in the law in case this day came, because it's been predicted a long time.
But laws can be repealed, Chris. I mean, that's not enshrined for all time.
Well, the way you enshrine it is if you change constitutions and state constitutions.
I mean, that's true, but you know. merely passing a state law would not have done
it. No, but a federal law, it would be difficult for the Congress to change that in many ways because of how strongly people feel about it. They just didn't. They left it hinged on a court ruling that many have been attacking for a long time, and Donald Trump got into office, packed the court with people that would do just that, even though they said different things when they were up for election. So, Laura, how...
It's interesting.
Oh, go ahead, Layla. Go ahead, Layla.
No, I was just going to say, you know, you mentioned the Clarence Thomas concurring opinion and the things that he intimated about, you know, the suggestion that the Supreme Court should consider overturning other landmark decisions, including, you know, the decisions granting rights to contraception and same-sex intimacy in marriage. And you know, I saw a tweet over the weekend. You know, it was actually from the actor Samuel L. Jackson, and he mentioned that notably, Thomas's opinion didn't mention the possibility of losing the right to interracial marriage that's protected by the Loving versus Virginia decision. Did anyone else note that was not mentioned among his? And of course, Clarence Thomas is married to a white woman.
And people have
is that a vulnerability?
Yeah. And people have said that, you know, if Clarence Thomas dies or leaves the court, that they will probably go to Loving versus Virginia and try to overturn that as well. So,
man.
Okay, so Laura, how available are abortions today in Ohio?
There are nine abortion clinics in the state, around 20,000 abortions performed there every year. And it's not who you would think that it would be. You know, so Zachary Smith broke down the numbers for us. And abortions in 2019, like 59% of them for ages 20 to 29, 28% for ages 30 to 39, about 15% are for married parents and patients. 64% of people received an abortion in 2019 already had one living child, and 60% had never had an abortion before. So we think there's this stereotype, right, that it's always like a young person, not of means, having an abortion, but it runs the gamut, the whole spectrum. And actually, Ohio abortions have been cut nearly in half since 1999. The sharpest decline has been among teenagers. And that's basically, they've been restricting abortion rights bill by bill as this all goes along. But one other thing that I found, a stat that was really interesting, was that 90% nationally of abortions are performed at 13 weeks or sooner, and about half are done with pills. So I think there's this really awful connotation about late term abortions, and they're all being medical procedures, and that's just not the case.
Lisa had mentioned Jim Obergefell. We heard from Mr. Obergefell. He was the namesake of the same-sex marriage ruling from, I think it was 2015.
Yeah.
What did he have to say?
Well, he basically said that he wasn't surprised. And he's in Ohio. He's running for the Ohio House as a Democrat. He said, you know, we've been watching the Ohio House kind of denigrate rights for years now. The transgender women bill from playing sports in high school, that passed the Ohio House, that hasn't officially become a law yet. But there's the Ohio House introduced a bill that put limitations on school instruction with this Don't Say Gay bill. He said, you know, he's watching these rights just disappear, and he's not surprised. He said, but today is all about women losing their right to make decisions about their own body. It's about government overreach and about invasion of privacy. So obviously he is running for election, so he used this time to make a statement, but he is the landmark case, right? That's his name. His name was referenced in the Supreme Court decision. So he'd use this to make a statement.
Well, and if you're willing to throw out a 50-year precedent, they'll be quick to throw out a 7-year precedent.
Well, and I've read some, you know, legal opinions, you know, that have said, okay, if the Constitution doesn't guarantee the right to an abortion, then it doesn't guarantee the right to privacy either, because abortion is a privacy matter. So is Griswold, which was, contraception for married couples. Lawrence, the sodomy law in Texas that was overturned in 2003, another privacy issue. So if they use that argument that there's no right to privacy, then a whole lot of things could fall.
The sad thing was is Justice Roberts laid the path that was proper for the court. He's saying, we don't have to rule on Roe v. Wade. That's not what's before us. What's before us is a very specific law, and that's what the court generally does. We don't reach further than we're asked to. But this is activist judges. It's hilarious because the Republicans are the ones that complain all the time about activist judges. These three that have been added are the activists, and they are using their weight. That's why the clause in Alito's ruling saying this is just about this ruling, it's not. It's about them all. They will be coming for them. So
yeah,
Layla,
I saw a statement from a conservative group. They ended up having a rally at the State House on Friday, and they said that the democracy has spoken. And you're like, how? What? Like, if you look at all of the polls, that's not democracy. That is activism.
Well, I guess they're saying that Donald Trump was elected president, and this is what he did. This is the result of democracy. It's the result of Donald Trump being elected president. Layla, once abortion is illegal in Ohio, women will have to go to other states if they have the means. Reporter Laura Hancock talked to some groups that plan to help them. What are they doing to get ready?
Yeah, these funds that Laura Hancock wrote about are doing the important work of circumnavigating this court decision by helping Ohio women with the costs of an abortion out of state, from gas and hotel rooms to child care and the procedure itself. The funds are called Women Have Options Ohio, which is 30 years old, and then Faith Choice Ohio, which has been around for decades but just started its abortion fund. Women Have Options has helped about 550 patients this year, and in addition to providing direct assistance to women, they also provide clinics with block grants to help low-income Ohioans with the cost of an abortion. And they have a phone line where people seeking abortions can leave a message, and then they get a call back from a patient navigator within 48 hours. And those navigators are women who have experienced abortions and can walk a woman through what to expect if she's planning on having one. In anticipation of an outright abortion ban in Ohio, Women Have Options is developing a legal support program too. And then there's Faith Choice Ohio. They've also been around for about 30 years, mostly training faith leaders across the state about how to help people lean into their pro-abortion values and speak about it in public. They've recently launched their pro-abortion fund with $40,000 in seed money and other donations. They operate under this really very interesting model. They distribute money directly to faith leaders who are protected by laws and rules of evidence known as priest penitent privilege or confessional privilege. Basically, a religious leader can't be compelled to testify against someone who shared personal information while visiting them for spiritual guidance, even if what they told the spiritual leader was something unlawful. So in this case, about their intention to seek an abortion. So for folks out there who have been trying to figure out how they can support women's right to choose despite the Supreme Court decision, they might want to consider getting behind these valiant efforts.
You know, Lisa, you and I have lived long enough to have been around before Roe v. Wade when it was illegal. And I was looking at some old newspaper articles in the Plain Dealer to look at what the conditions were back then. And I saw that religious leaders in Cleveland had formed a group to counsel women that wanted to have abortion. And if they maintained that they wanted to have an abortion, help them get them, even though they were illegal in Ohio. It was a cross-section of ministers that recognized the woman's right to choose. You just wonder if the same climate develops now. No, Lisa?
I don't know if that'll happen among faith leaders. We'll see. I mean, obviously, there are some churches who feel that it's a right and others that don't. So it'll be interesting to see how this comes out. But yes, there was quite an underground network pre-1973. Unfortunately, you know, you have the view of back alley abortions, which did happen. But there was actually like an underground network of professionals and faith leaders and community leaders that got women safe abortions, and that's going to happen again. If they think that people are going to stop having abortions and give it back to the states, or you're going to have to drive who knows how far to get an abortion, obviously some people can't do that. So I think that underground network is going to reform if it ever went away.
Yeah, I also heard from a couple of Intel stockholders that are going to go to Intel and say, you ought to hold up your deal in Ohio if they continue down this road. Well, that's going to happen. Companies are going to be called to account. Where do you stand? You saw Dick's Sporting Goods immediately came out and said they would provide money to employees to travel to states where abortions are legal. People are also pointing out Dick's Sporting Goods has contributed to many of the politicians who want to outlaw abortion. Interesting stuff. It's a topic we'll be talking about again. It was worth a deep dive today. You are listening to Today in Ohio. As expected, the Ohio Supreme Court did reject Secretary of State Frank LaRose's underhanded efforts to keep Democrats off the special election ballot in August, even though the overseas version of those ballots had been mailed. Lisa, what did the court rule, and what happens now?
On Friday, the Ohio Supreme Court voted 4-3 to allow six Democratic candidates to appear on the August 2nd primary ballot. That was a reversal of Secretary of State Frank LaRose's decision to leave them off because of disagreement over the 90-day filing deadline, which, of course, changed with all the different maps and everything else. So this broke down along the familiar lines in the Supreme Court, voting to allow these candidates on the ballot: Maureen O'Connor, Jennifer Bruner, Melody Stewart, and Michael Donnelly. Their opinion, they stated that state law says 90 days before the election. So, you know, that would not be February 2nd for the August 2nd election, and it would be 72 days for any write-in candidates. Sharon Kennedy, Patrick Fisher, and Patrick DeWine on the dissent wrote that all candidates should have been rejected. Unfortunately, LaRose mailed overseas and military ballots last week without these names. He's reviewing the opinion and has no comment right now, but I don't know, can they take those ballots back? Are they going to mail another ballot? They really haven't said at this point.
Yeah, this was obvious that they had to do this. The state law was clear, and LaRose really was playing politics to keep Democrats off the ballot. Republicans all ultimately got involved, but this was really about the Democrats. And shame on the three justices who said they should have been rejected. This is not about partisan politics. It's about what's right. And they filed within the correct timeline. I continue to be surprised that people say Frank LaRose has done a pretty good job as Secretary of State. He's making it harder for people to be on the ballot. It's not what you're supposed to
do. I have completely changed my opinion of Frank LaRose since I came on the editorial board. At first, I thought he was kind of fair and kind of walked that tightrope, you know, in between, you know, good and bad or whatever you want to say. And I thought he handled the pandemic election pretty well, but he has really gone to the dark side since then.
Yeah, he really has. And we figured the Supreme Court would slap him silly, and they did. You're listening to Today in Ohio. Remember Cleveland Rising? It was that multi-day effort to bring together lots of people from various walks of life to imagine how Cleveland could become a city of prosperity for all. Just published a report listing how it succeeded and how it did not. Laura, the story we wrote, should have disclosed that I was part of the organizing team for that. It's always bad when we have a story in which I was a participant. We don't disclose it. Disclosing it here, what's the upshot of the report?
Basically, that it was well-meaning but doesn't have a lot of results. And honestly, this is how I thought it would end up, like a well-meaning kumbaya. But every couple of years, we get these really big philanthropy business pushes, and we're going to figure out how to make Cleveland shine and come up with the next big technology and solve all of our problems. And then it's like nothing. I mean, you look at Blockland, I feel like they're sort of similar. But this new report about the 600-person endeavor, so it was a huge effort. It blames COVID in part, and you can't completely discount that, because for months after, they were showing progress. It kicked off in October 2019. It was a three-day summit at Public Auditorium, and the whole goal was to bring people from all different backgrounds, ethnicities, worldviews together to exchange these ideas. They were divided into working group on different goals. I believe there were magic markers involved. Correct me if I'm wrong. But the idea was they were going to come
up. You're not wrong.
Not wrong? There were markers? Okay.
Lots of markers.
Okay. And so these groups met for 3 days, and then they kept meeting afterwards with really big, lofty topics about, you know, they wanted to eliminate all health disparities. They wanted no more food deserts. They wanted wraparound services for everyone needed them. They wanted universal child care and accessible parental leave. And so these are not things that you can solve quickly, and definitely while you've got a pandemic that kind of takes precedence over everything else.
One of the ways I think they pulled their punches is that when you talk to people privately, they talk about how Frank Jackson refused to let anybody from the city participate. Some city officials actually signed up and then had to back out. If you don't have buy-in across the board as you're trying to remove the boundaries to try and get rid of all of the isolation, then it's not going to work. And it was Frank Jackson was across the street and never stepped foot into his public hall to even welcome the people together. And so I know that years later, people look back and say that was a major failing. Armin Budish, on the other hand, did participate. I don't know that you can call it a failure when you get, whatever it was, 600 people from various backgrounds together to dream about what the city could be. It is almost impossible to get anything done when you have 600 people involved.
Right.
But remember, this is the place where the idea of making RTA free really got some traction.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, it's never a bad idea to talk about the future and come up with it. But I just don't love that this is always like, this is going to be it. This is so different from every other attempt before, and this is going to fix it. But they did talk about how the fact that there were so many people actually made it very difficult to agree on anything and figure out the next steps. And also that it was so grassroots, they didn't really have access to the leaders in every issue. And so it was hard to get anything done. And so, you want to include everyone, but you also want to have the people who can make it happen involved, like you said about Jackson.
I mean, Layla, you remember there was a rudimentary misunderstanding of how certain elements of government work. People would say things and there was nobody to say, okay, but, you know, the laws require X and Y. And so that kept holding up the conversations because they would go down a path that was an absolute impossibility.
That's right. You know, I remember sitting in on one group that went on and on and on for hours. I won't disclose exactly what they were working on, but the end result of it was that they had decided that there should be the formation of this one, you know, particular kind of entity, one body, one sort of like sub-governmental. And then somebody suggested, well, actually, that already exists. And then that was the result of hours of work. And then everyone's like, well, we should get that group to work better. How do we do that? And everyone just sort of was deflated at the end of that. And it was just, I don't know. I feel like I could have written the advance obit of this right after the event ended.
Such cynicism in such young people.
I know.
You're listening to Today in Ohio. Let's try and do one more short one. We reached out to legal experts to ask whether Deshaun Watson's decision to settle lawsuits against him was really the only practical option available to him. Lisa, I thought reporter Corey Schaefer's story on this was one of the best things we published in the past week. What did we find?
Yeah, he talked to three different legal experts, two of them here in Cleveland and one a New York attorney, and they basically agreed. They say that settlements are really, really common in these kind of cases and usually the best option, even if they're falsely accused. Andrew Brettler, who's a New York attorney who's represented actor Chris Noth and Prince Andrew as clients, said going to trial means a lot of years in court, continued media scrutiny, mounting attorney fees, and then in Watson's case, it would affect team morale because they're going through it along with him. He also said, if you go to trial, you have to win. Ian Friedman, a Cleveland attorney who represents those accused of sexual misconduct, says, quote, how much of your life do you want to give up for this? Can you pay and move on? Fighting all 24 claims would take years. Now, Larry Zuckerman, also a Cleveland attorney, he represents athletes. He took a slightly different tack. He says, if you didn't do anything wrong, you maintain your innocence and you fight for it. He said settlements can encourage other accusers to speak out, but he did agree that a spectacle like this is a distraction and it's a very delicate balance. But in his experience with his clients, he says he's done better fighting in court.
There is something to the idea where if you really believe you didn't do anything wrong, you fight it. That's what Matt Borges is doing at HB6. He is going down hard. And if he's truly innocent, it'll be a long, expensive battle that takes a lot out of him. But he says, I'm going to clear my name. Zuckerman has a point, mm-hmm. right?
He does. But, you know, then again, I mean, Tony Busby is his expert at manipulating the media. He would have kept this front and center for until the trials all went to trial. I mean, and even afterwards. So, I mean, that kind of scrutiny, do you really want to go through that? I mean, it ruins your reputation that way.
Yeah, look at Johnny Depp. He ultimately prevailed in that trial, but there was a lot of damage. Anyway, it's a great story by Corey Safer. Take it out on Cleveland.com. It'll make you think a little bit more about this case in a way you have not. That does it for an episode of Today in Ohio on a Monday morning. Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Layla. Thanks to everybody who listens. We'll be back on Tuesday to be talking about the news.